We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 30. I'm Jessica Yaquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we're talking about cultural landscapes. And we're actually recording live at the SAA's 2019. And so there's a whole group of us here to talk about cultural landscapes. And I'm going to pass the microphone to Brees, and he's going to get started introducing everyone.
Hello, my name is Brees Edwards. I'm the deputy tip of for the Tribal Historic Preservation Office at the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
I'm Cassie Rippey. I am the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Coquille Indian Tribe based out of Coos Bay, Oregon.
I'm Michelle Lapina. I am a member of the Pitt River Tribe, and I'm a tribal attorney for many tribes in California and now in other states.
I'm Sean Gant. I'm the Director of Education at Crow Canyon Archaeological Center.
Hey, my name is Wade Campbell. I'm a fifth-year archaeology PhD student at Harvard.
Tanse, I'm Dr. Keisha Supernanch. I am an associate professor at the University of Alberta, and I'm a member of the Métis Nation of Alberta, and I'm also a descendant of the Papas Chase Cree, and I do work with the Métis community and with First Nations in British Columbia.
So, Dr. Supernanch, since you have to head out in a little bit here, and also because you're the only one that hasn't been on a podcast episode before, could you start us out by talking a little bit about your work with cultural landscapes in the past?
Thank you. Yes. So I've been working on cultural landscapes and landscape approaches in archaeology in Indigenous contexts for almost 15 years now. So I did my dissertation work in the Lower Fraser River Canyon in British Columbia, working with the Yale First Nation and the Stolo Nation, Stolo Tribal Council, doing a exploration of a series of rock walls in the area. And it took a landscape approach, trying to make sense of what these walls were doing in the community. I did mapping of them and did some GIS analysis. And through that process, I became introduced to thinking about landscapes and engaging with some of that literature. And since then, I have sort of broadened and deepened my understandings of landscape as I move back to my homeland. And I now live in Amiskutuwaskahigan, which is the Cree name for Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And that's the area where my family is from. And so now I work a lot with my own community to understand our history on the land. And that has created a bit of a new approach that I have taken to look at the different ways in which our identity is connected to the lands. We're a highly mobile people, so we were known for our mobility, moving often 1,000 kilometers in the course of a season across the prairies. So between kind of nodes at Red River, what's now Winnipeg, Manitoba, Fort Edmonton in Edmonton, and many areas in between. There was another hub kind of down in northern Montana as well. And so this sort of triangle of parts of our homeland that we'd move through. So how do you understand our history when we're mobile, but we're also really strongly connected to place, right? So there's been a tendency to kind of either ground us in a particular place. So you're from Red River or you're from here, from Edmonton, but not understanding how we can be both rooted and mobile at the same time. So I'm now taking an approach in my research that draws on a concept from two of my colleagues, Brendan McDougall and Nicole Saint-Ange, called kinscapes, which looks at how we are related to the land in particular sorts of ways, and how the land also helps us reinforce the kin networks that we're in with our human kin, with our other than human kin, with waters and lands and plants and animals, and looking at that as a model for understanding more of our connection and how some of these nodes and places are places where we come together. Right, so we tended to gather in particular places, either for buffalo hunting, and then later on for pilgrimage locations, and we'd come together and practice those sort of kin networks, connect with one another, learn, share, often actually enter into new kin relationships through marriage and things like that. So the model of kinscapes has sort of allowed me to take the technical elements of something like a GIS, which is something I have a specialization in. And think about a richer and deeper way of understanding it. Because GIS is a powerful tool, but it's also very limiting because it can't really incorporate Indigenous knowledge. It can, you know, put points on a map and it can make beautiful maps sometimes, but that's not being in place. That's not actually capturing the experience of being there and what that means. It's not capturing the fullness of how someone, an Indigenous person, might move through a landscape in very particular sorts of ways and how they have certain types of knowledge around, you know, the wind or the smell of a place or the deep cultural knowledge from their ancestors of why this place is this particular way. A GIS, it can't really do that. And so I use it as a tool, but it's also a way in which it needs to be enriched by these broader frameworks.
Well, and I think that plays in interestingly with Wade's talk the other night. It just seemed like there was a lot of connections there with what you were talking about the other night with Dene Sheperding and the movement, but at the same time, connection to place. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you talked about?
Yeah, sure. So my presentation was on the first phase of my dissertation research on early Navajo herding and the history of that and how the subject is something that has kind of laid outside the grasp of historians and folks that have been interested in the question, and even other archaeologists, in part because traditionally studies of pastoralism and herding have depended on using zooarchaeological means, using animal bones to interpret, to act as sort of direct evidence for animals at a place and humans' relationship with them. The issue, though, is that Navajo sites in general are kind of ephemeral. And given the age and given the nature of Navajo subsistence practices and sort of attitudes towards animals and bones and things, there actually is an argument to be had that zoo archaeology is not the best approach at all. And so with these issues of mine, I dreamt up a project that combines both the sort of ingrained sort of firsthand knowledge of sheep herding with subsurface testing as part of an attempt to take a landscape approach towards herding, understanding how people are working with their flocks across a landscape. And so the presentation that I gave on Thursday night was sort of summing up the first part of that, which was working with my family my extended family at our sheep camp on Black Mesa in the central part of the Navajo Nation, and herding for 6 months and recording the different archaeological sites and features associated with both herding and sort of long-term habitation in the area. And the goal is to use that as a way to model out herding activities and then apply it to areas in New Mexico where there are older Navajo sites from the colonial period, a period in which we haven't really been able to understand how Navajos incorporated sheep in following the Spanish arrival, and how the different communities sort of negotiated the various social and economic and environmental impacts that come with having livestock. And so in that, you know, it was a really kind of powerful experience. And one of the things I wanted to highlight for people in my talk, and so I developed a few slides to do so, was that Navajo sites are by nature very ephemeral, and corrals can be incredibly ephemeral. You know, you're talking about essentially an enclosure and then the space inside. And it's that the combination, that sort of the positive feature and the negative space that sort of define the corral. But if the positive feature, the wall, the kind of enclosing element is taken away, you're left with really just a soil stain, you know, kind of the built up accumulation of sort of refuse and dung. But that can be hard to spot. And so, you know, I was sort of drawing attention to that. You know, there are indicators if you know what to look for, but you have to train that. Much the same way you actually have to train to identify traditional Navajo structures, mm-hmm. Hogans or other temporary camps that can be hard to see, especially if you've been trained in the Southwest to look at room blocks and look for Anasazi pottery. Mm-hmm. These things that are really kind of, you know, earth and wood structures can really slip under the radar. And so the best way to get firsthand experience with that is, right, to be on the landscape, working with these, working with animals and then trying to take that and apply it to the questions at hand.
And, what technology were you using to to do this?
The technology. So I use GPS units, but my friends nicknamed them SheePS units because because I used some really kind of simple GPS data loggers, but had a upholsterer in my town, Gallup, construct neck belt things that I could put the GPSs into. And they work great, but the one tricky part of the matter was that, you know, basically the batteries lasted for a day and then I'd have to charge them. So the trickiest part of the whole thing was basically switching out the battery, which in the case of the goat that had the thing, I could trick the goat into coming over and nibbling my fingers, and then I could grab the thing and switch it out. Mm-hmm. But the sheep was a lot more wary, and so I had to rope him every morning. And so that was always a kind of a fun experience.
Good time.
Yeah. Oh, hi, so this is Michelle. I wanted to just talk about, briefly, since I have to go, my before I was in law school, the introduction to cultural landscapes was with Mount Shasta. And that was something that I did. I wrote about in a local tribal, well, it's not even a tribal journal, but it's called News from Native California. And it's a magazine that's about California Indians, and a lot of California Indians write for it. And so I started writing articles because we were really worried about development of Mount Shasta because it's a sacred place. And so it was then that I learned about the NHPA and cosmological districts and how we can tie places together to save a larger area. And so that really piqued my interest in sacred site protection. But more recently, it's kind of the opposite in a way. One of my issues that I'm working on for a client is an unrecognized tribe in the Bay Area. And through the cultural preservation laws that I and others have been working on in California that I've talked about on another episode.
Right.
We have consultation required for development where there's going to be a cultural site or traditional cultural place in California. And we included the unrecognized tribes so that they would have a right to consultation. And so this site is actually in, it's called the West Berkeley Shell Mound, and it's one of the last partially intact shell mounds in the Bay Area. And when I looked at it more broadly, there's hundreds of shell mounds all across the state of California, all across the coast, and it's just part of a cultural way of burial. But it includes, it's really... The mounds are included in part of the everyday life. And so they would actually build these mounds and people would actually live on them. I recently wrote a piece for a journal with some of the local Ohlone people talking about the preservation of the shell mounds and what they mean. And I mean, how I approached it was, you know, the idea of being buried in shells, because these are, you know, shells are valuable. They're our precious commodity. They're our jewelry. They're money. Mm-hmm. And to be buried in shells, what an honor that would be. Mm-hmm. And so to say that these places are like refuse and trash heaps, you know, was just really wrong. And the interesting thing about the shell mounds is even though they aren't really a cosmological district or a cultural landscape, they are distinct. And so preserving each one is very important. And so it is kind of the reverse of what we were doing with Mount Shasta. We're trying to bring all these related sites that were connected through cultural stories, oral tradition, and practical use. With the shell mounds, we're just really zeroing in on this, like, this place and how important it is. And that mound is actually just paved. It's a parking lot for Spanger's restaurant. It's an old seafood restaurant in Berkeley, and it's been capped. And one of the things that I've noticed in my travels in California is that these places kind of, some of them protect themselves, and you see them being avoided sometimes and capped over, obviously not all the time because we've lost so many, but this one has been capped, and so we're trying to keep it from being built on. There's a planned housing development and shopping center on it, and there's a lot of reasons why it shouldn't be there. But yeah, the idea that these are tied together into this larger story, you lose a lot of the larger story and the value if you lose that one piece of it. And that is a piece that has been extensively excavated by UC Berkeley. I mean, they have enough out of that site.
And actually, the Phoebe Hearst Museum testified in support of preserving the site because they said that it is such a valuable site that it shouldn't be disturbed anymore. And in fact, we'd like to bring all of those ancestors and the other items and put them back. And this would be an opportunity to put them back. So it is information that is unfortunately publicly available. There's maps, books, and guides to the shell mounds of the Bay Area. And so people can go out and kind of loot these places. But this is a place where we hope to protect it. So I wanted to add that to the discussion.
Yeah, and for our listeners who may not know that much about that, like me, I don't know what this means. What is capping?
Oh, capping is it's a quote preservation method where you just cover it. Okay. So instead of excavating it, you just cover it with something. So to cap it, a lot of parking lots become or cultural sites become parking lots. Mm-hmm. You know, it is. From a native viewpoint, I mean, it hurts me to know that there's ancestors getting drove over and, you know, your cars leak. And there's actually a site that in Sacramento, well, most of Sacramento is a burial ground at some point or another because of the location next to the water. But and where I live in Sacramento, there's a lot of capped sites. And then whenever they do any kind of road work or sewer lines or anything, they cut through the ancestors. And then there's places where they are put back under the sidewalk. And it's very sad. You know, it's just the way things are today. And, you know, we try to mitigate the effect of it on the people today and keep the ancestors together and intact.
This is Keisha again, and I just wanted to follow up from what Michelle was saying, because we've been doing some work in the city of Edmonton, because the southern half of the city was originally surveyed as a reserve for the Papas Chase Cree, and I'm a descendant of them. And then through, you know, the land speculation and swindling and all this sort of thing, it was illegally surrendered in the late 1880s. And then the city of Edmonton is now built on top of that reserve land. And we've been working in collaboration with Chief Calvin Bruneau of the Papas Chase, because they're looking to get federal recognition, because they also were, you know, as they lost the reserve, they also no longer were federally recognized. And one of the things that we've been doing is trying to locate a burial ground, which shows up on some of the early maps. And we're using remote sensing technology, which is a way, of course, to look under the surface of the ground without disturbing, to see if we can locate this burial ground, one, to help support them in their claim for that place, but two, to ensure that that place stays protected so that the ancestors don't get disturbed. And the land we think it might be on was just sold to a developer, so it's particularly urgent right now. And so this summer we're going to be going out with some ground penetrating radar and some magnetometry and a few other tools to try to see if we can help us locate our ancestors who were buried there, so we can continue to protect it. And it's particularly acute in urban spaces, right, because they have this history of building on, you know, every major city in North America is probably built on a burial ground of some kind, right? Yeah. So it's important to do this work in those spaces too.
That kind of brings something up that I heard the other morning. This is Sean, by the way. So I was in a session that was kind of about Tejeras Pueblo, which is a site that I used to manage for the Forest Service when I was in grad school here at UNM. And there was an artist from Isleta Pueblo who is doing a mural map in the Tejeras Pueblo museum interpretive space that the Friends of Tejeras Pueblo have created there. And so it's sort of a map of the Tiwa world at the time of Tejeras Pueblo. And one of the things that she did in her mural is she has a symbol that she puts for everywhere she thinks that there was a Tiwa village, you know, along the Rio Grande. And, you know, one of the points that she made that I think is a good point. I think it's probably very accurate. And it also helps us get a sense for the kind of overall layout and spread of those villages, is everywhere you look and see an old Spanish church, that's probably a village, because it was probably built on a kiva. And we know it's certainly on the East Mountains, like San Antonio, that old church is built directly on top of a kiva. And so I think that pattern is probably pretty pervasive throughout this area. And so as a way of thinking about that, if you just kind of visualize how many of those old churches there are, that probably gives you a good idea of where villages were located all throughout this area. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that kind of relates to what you guys are talking about.
Sure. Right. Well, and that kind of reminds me, too, of the Zuni mapping project. And representing cultural landscapes through art. So if anybody hasn't seen that, you should definitely look into it. It's very interesting.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
I would just throw in a little something about my son, because there's the next generation. But he's a GIS student, a master's student at San Francisco State. And what he's been doing is he also concluded that GIS is there's all this information, but it means nothing. And from a tribal perspective, at the end of the day, because you lose all the context for the reason why you were mapping it. And so he's decided to just make art out of his maps. And so instead of, so he's manipulating the layers to have the place. So if there's a place of power or a cultural place, he can take that map and he can fool with the layers and the colors and create what he believes the site actually is and feels like. And so I think that's really interesting that this next generation will probably take that technology and take it to a place that it wasn't intended to go, but it's going to go anyway.
I mean, so right, this comment though, I mean, you know, mapping in GIS is both sort of analytical, but it can also be interpretive. It's a powerful tool for visualization. And I think, you know, that's something that is drawn out time and again. It's interesting because you see a lot of archaeological maps that some, you know, have features missing, or they render everything down into, you know, thin black lines on a white page. And so moving past that in ways that kind of engage the viewers and get them to think kind of critically about sort of past native spaces. And there was actually, last week I was at the American Association of Geographers annual meeting, and there was the book by a professor at Columbia, I forget what his name is, but his book is about the contact between plains groups and Chinese laborers. And his maps in there, a series of them are very clearly oriented. They're oriented to the page cleverly, but in that they're twisted so that north is on the left-hand side of the page and east is up. And so it fits the image of the railroad and stuff. But then on the map itself, it's been, you know, there's GIS layers clearly, you see that. But then there's also these other elements pulled in with the mountain ranges and then traditional elements of Cheyenne mythology sort of overlaying onto different regions, which, as I understand, kind of reading through that they represent. You know, so thinking about how you convey data, even simply not doing north is up, right? But how you convey it. And if I may, because like Michelle, I kind of have to run. But there's another element that I wanted to maybe touch on, which was the idea of sort of landscapes and or the political landscapes. And it's a clunky segue, perhaps, right? But talking about some of the stuff at the SAAs. And well, one of the things that in my case, I wanted to highlight was that I had organized a session that was entitled which is essentially basically by telling stories is how we learn about the past, Diné archaeologists and Navajo archaeology in the 21st century. And it was kind of remarkable or noteworthy for a couple of reasons, one of which was that it was the first Navajo-focused session in 20 years at the SAAs. And with the exception of one discussant, everybody, presenters, discussants alike, were Navajo. And the research that we dealt with spanned 4 centuries worth of Navajo history and culture. And so it was really kind of a neat thing, but it was, in many ways, it was intended to be a statement piece of some sorts about sort of the position of non-Puebloan groups in the American Southwest and how archaeology has dealt with them. Not just Navajo, but Apaches and Utes and Comanches, and that only in the past 15 years, arguably, are you really seeing people grapple with the mobile populations. And archaeology has a problem with mobility, and thinking about mobility in ways that sort of encourage critical discussion and thought. And so part of this session was to kind of have a showcase, a body of work done by Native scholars about their own culture, their own history, in part as an effort to reclaim some of the history making that archaeologists have had a heavy hand in. And in the case of the Southwest, Navajos have always been portrayed as, not always, but long been portrayed as latecomers, cultural borrowers, and the like. And our opening piece was by a Dinette professor, Carrie Thompson, at Northern Arizona University, who sort of set the stage with a talk that was entitled Trapped by a Paradigm, and was sort of arguing that this, you know, thinking about mobility and linguistics in an uncritical manner has, in the early 1900s, has led to a situation in the 21st century where, you know, you have to sort of fight for the right to say something that contravenes the established Southwestern archaeology, sort of the Southwestern archaeological narrative. And it's heartening to see, though, that we're talking about sort of in the warm-up to all this, that there are a lot of, this is a browner SAAs than has been had previously. And so thinking about shifting the landscape, I think, is a really interesting thing. And this conference has done that in some interesting ways over the past few days already. And so I think maybe it'd be kind of neat to talk about that as well.
So I think following up on some of what Wade said about the importance of us doing our own mapping and our own work on our own communities is a really important one. And also there has been a real rise in sort of counter mapping. So I don't know if people are aware, but there's an Indigenous mapping workshop that's held every year in Canada. And it's about Indigenous mapping and mappers and sort of hacking the technology. So coming back to Michelle's example, which was fantastic. And one of the things that I have done some work on is pushing back against archaeological models of mobility and how they don't really work. So I did I published a paper in 2017. It's called Modeling Métis Mobility. And I compared historic trails, which we know from early maps, and did least cost paths over the same landscapes and then tried to see if they matched up or not as sort of a way to say, do least cost paths actually capture the ways in which we know that Métis moved over the landscape? And in that, I concluded there are times they do, but times they really don't. And so it doesn't really capture movement. And also, we have to consider a whole bunch of other things like seasonality, right? So I live in a part of the world where there's snow on the ground 6 months of the year. And these trails are modeled after carts, Red River carts moving across the landscape. In the winter, they'd be on dog sled. Try modeling dog sled on snow. No one, as far as I know, no one's actually attempted it.
Yeah.
When I looked at the literature. So I think we need to, you know, again, think about the possibilities of things like GIS, but also its limitations and how we can hack it, right? Hack it right. For our own purposes. I've been using a tool called Story Maps, which is an Esri product through ArcGIS Online. It's free to use. And it is a method to combine text, images, videos, and maps in an interactive format. There's a whole bunch of different sort of templates. They're pretty graphically engaging in that they already give you a pretty good setup for what you can do. I use them now as a teaching tool for my students, and so I have them create story maps. And we did a story map for the Pappas Chase, who we've been working with in Edmonton, and telling the history, because it's not well known by people who live there, that they don't realize they're living on what should have been a reserve land, for example. I actually live there. And I say, like, I bought back a piece of my family's land at an exorbitant price. But the story map has become an important tool for them communicating. Like, their lawyer is now using it to take it out and to show people. And we combined historical maps, archaeological data, information from elders in the community about that, the history, you know, pictures of documents of, like, letters of written about it and that kind of thing, to create this narrative to help people understand the history of that land. So there are tools we can use, but it is important for it to be an Indigenous-driven content generation and ensuring that the concepts and things are grounded in those communities and places.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to talk about how we can capture data or information that is kind of perceived as not mappable. And we did a project several years ago, going back to the old ethnohistoric notes, and we went line by line and set up databases. And every time there's an animal, mineral, vegetable, it went into the database. And then we came back, and where we could identify where those specific loci were, we went and we mapped that. But we put it up on a wall. We did a printout of 1 inch to a quarter mile. So it was 8 feet tall, 30 feet long, and then we put Mylar over it. And so we went through this stage of mapping by hand, and then as community was coming in, they added more places because it sparked more information. And then we brought all of that back in, and then we scanned it back into the GIS and then made it active and linked each to the data set. We now have a, if you will, a cultural landscape of 1880, and as it was understood when it being written, then we were able to take other information and start layering that in. So we were able to capture out of historic notes information and make it interactive, and now we have something that we can point to and say, let's avoid this, or let's have a conversation before you go into this. It's all documented and it's all public record. It's all public domain, so we're not jeopardizing any of those internal concerns that we have.
For the Coquel, we have a challenge in our area in that we are not a treaty tribe and we're not a reservation tribe. The Coquel signed several treaties, which none of which were ratified. And so through the Oregon Land Donation Act and removal and the Dawes Allotment Act, most of the property that was our ancestral territory and our usual not accustomed lands are now in either federal land ownership or in private land ownership, a lot of private land ownership. And so one of the challenges that we have is in working within that realm of our neighbors and our community and educating them that they are on not only a traditional cultural landscape, but a living cultural landscape. Mm-hmm. And so we have the challenge in that we have to teach them how to be stewards of something that they don't feel connected with. They feel is a land grab. The Coquel, we have our own traditional cultural property nomination that we're working on. The state of Oregon doesn't have any listed traditional cultural properties on the National Register at the moment. There is one from another tribe, the Confederated Tribes of Coos Loroim Coen Sayuslaw, who have made it past the initial stages and are on the way to national parks here in a couple of weeks. But it has become contentious, and Wade said very astutely, the political landscape. The political landscape in Oregon is hot right now. And we as a tribe have to figure out how to navigate protecting our cultural and spiritual integrity while also working with our neighbors and working with that community. One of the things that is our biggest message is that integrity doesn't necessarily have to mean what people think it means. It doesn't have to be physical integrity. The landscape in Oregon on the South Oregon coast has changed significantly. The mouth of the Coquille River is a half of a mile south of where it was 150 years ago. Right. And so when people refer to a map, they say, oh, well, it says here that the village was at the mouth of the Coquille. okay, do you know where that was? Let's talk about that. So getting our community to really understand how the settlers and soldiers and our modern community, urban growth is up almost 20% in the last 5 years. How that has affected our living landscape is dramatic, and it's hard to express that in a way that really makes sense to a lot of people. So that's one of our challenges, is to teach people that we are on this landscape. It has changed, but the significance hasn't changed.
Well, and I think, you know, going along with the idea of a living landscape, I think that a lot of times from the archaeological perspective, people think about, you know, sites and the built environment in particular. I think there's an overemphasis on the built environment. And I've argued that from an indigenous epistemology, natural places and locations are equally as important often as the built environment. And so when we are looking at and kind of building our idea of cultural landscapes, but focusing solely on the built environment, I think we're missing a lot of information there. And I think that gets back to the root of a lot of landscape archaeology, cultural landscape studies that comes out of the philosophical tradition of phenomenology and what place feels like, how places experience bodily. And one of the distinctions that I really, you know, it's something that Keith Basso said in, I took his last ethnography of place course at UNM before he retired, and he made this distinction between a site and a place. And so a site is like the physical location on the ground, but a place is really all the meanings and significance that's put onto that site. So this idea that you could have one site that's actually many different places to different people, or even for at different times in somebody's life, that's something that's always stuck with me and been an idea that I think is really profound but simple. And so in the work that we're doing in Southwest Colorado with Crow Canyon, I think one of the areas that I really want to get into is thinking about that central Mesa Verde region as a truly a multicultural landscape that has all kinds of layers of placemaking and significant locations on it. And some of those, like Wade was talking about, are going to be very hard to notice if you're looking for wall alignments and structures. There was a presentation this morning about teepee rings over around Bluff. And, you know, if you're going out looking for certain types of archaeology, I feel like it's very easy to miss something super ephemeral like that. But those are significant places as well for other groups.
Yeah. So the built environment is an object of particular contention for the tribes. In the city of Bandon, we have a sacred rock feature called Grandmother Rock, Omashi. Is part of a traditional storyscape. She is a person transmogrified to stone. And she remains a spiritual and cultural leader for the tribe. But she was blown up and used as jetty fill in the 1890s and 1900s. She's one of our TCP nominations. Her lack of integrity doesn't diminish her significance. The fact that she is in a different place is tragic, but it's not the point, right? So the Army Corps had a project coming along in our area, and their project is on the jetties and on the piers. And they said, well, it's built environment, and so no effect. And so my question came back to them and said, what is it built out of? Right. This is built out of, in part, a person. She may be stone now, but she's a person. She's a sacred object. So consider what your built environment is. Fortunately, it turns out that this one piece of the pier doesn't have Grandmother Rock on the part that's going to be infected. So that, thank goodness. But we have to bring that back to you and say, okay, it's built environment, but built of what?
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th Annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore Dance at noon and Grand Entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fry bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
One thing that I think you may have been starting to get at is archaeologists are really good with nouns, you know, place and things. And so you get the laundry list. But that's, it gets limiting because of that. You know, through tribal engagement, indigenous archaeology, you get to have practice. You get the verb, you get action, and you get to find a sentence when you bring those two together. And it allows you to find those ephemeral. It allows you to identify place, big P, right. In a way that you wouldn't otherwise. You're not relegated to give me physical evidence. But the other side of that is it's hard to put a line around it when you're talking about a place of practice. Mm-hmm. Because practice, as an elder, you know, kind of pointed out, is it's as big as I need it to be.
Right.
And it always was unlimited, unbounded. It is now unlimited and unbounded. And so when we're having conversations as TIPOs in the world of consultation and regulatory actions, those are hard concepts to bring in mm-hmm. to the uninformed, the uninitiated, or just plain ignorant. Mm. But it's important, and I'm open to ideas and ways to do that, because otherwise you get those occasions of it's a built environment, like Cassie was talking about.
Well, I mean, and a good example is I feel like a lot of times the lines that are drawn around archaeological sites saying, okay, well, here's the site, right? Well, that might be where there's the archaeology, where there's something built, but, like, why is it there? So, like, it makes me think about Naniwea, which is the mother mound for the Choctaw people. And so for my dissertation work, I was actually working for the tribe and doing some interpretive work around Naniwea because they had just gotten it back from the state, basically. And, you know, if you think about the Middle Woodland Platform Mound as the site, you miss the fact that the reason that site's there, why it's important, is that there's the headwaters of the Pearl River and a cave system that's a very unique geologic feature in the area that's probably why the site was built there to begin with. So, like, if you lopped that off as though that's the important part, you would miss the actual culturally important side on the other side of the swamp. So I think that's a good example of, like, we got to be careful how we draw those lines, like you're saying.
So we've talked about cultural landscapes now from kind of a wide variety of angles. But if you're a listener listening to this, what can you take from that, and where, you know, what's kind of an action step that they can take, or a place they can go with everything that they've learned today?
Okay, I think from my perspective, one of the reasons I'm really interested in this topic is working at Crow Canyon, I run the education department, and so we have around 2,000 kids a year come through our programs. And I think giving kids an understanding that archaeology can be bigger than just focusing on, you know, this great house or this other site, but looking at it from the landscape perspective and kind of trying to visualize and understand what it would have been like to live in that landscape. That's a lot of what we do with kids, and through teaching them different, like, actual skills, like fire making and cordage making and looking at the landscape from where we're at. And I think one of the things that Southwest Archaeology's focus on the Pueblo occupation and particular types of sites is that some of those more ephemeral sites, like what Wade was talking about, get left out of the picture. And so our local Native American population in Cortez is primarily Ute and Navajo. And I feel like if their placemaking and their significance in the landscape is not included in the archaeological education and interpretation that we're doing in the Four Corners, then those kids, even though they live there and they know that they have places and they know that there are stories associated with those places, they may not feel like their story is important or included in the way archaeology is understood. And if we are serious about engaging young Native people and getting them into the industry and moving them into these career paths, I feel like we've got to do a better job of building programs that helps them see themselves reflected in the archaeology and that will help encourage them to go into these kind of careers.
I think that's awesome. We've had similar conversations, and we kind of have decided to try and take the narrative to a place of landcestry, that any given place may have a time depth and connection to many people, and as a way of how to break a single narrative. Because there is a need to recognize that, you know, especially an academic narrative that is rooted in 1900, yeah, that's a little limiting. So let's find a vocabulary to at least start erecting a framework to work from now that can be a bit more inclusive. So landcestry is one that seems to be sticking. And just talking about landscape and literally remind people to position themselves around a particular landform that, for us, it's Mount Hood. Seen for hundreds of miles, and everybody has a connection to it. And isn't that great? That brings a gravity to that place and doesn't diminish anybody's connection to it as a result.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because, you know, I don't want anyone to take what I'm saying to imply that I don't think that Pueblo folks have a very important connection to the area of the world, because obviously they do, and obviously that's super important. But all I'm basically arguing is that that's not the only placemaking that's happened in that landscape, and that if we ignore the rest of it, then it's, I think, to the detriment of those kids and those populations that, you know, we kind of sometimes marginalize in those conversations. But certainly there are significant landforms that, you know, there's going to be all kinds of different stories and connections and importance attached to by many different groups. And it's what Veronica Strange, I believe, called uncommon ground in talking about the Australian context, where you could have the same landscape but with very different meanings and understandings of that landscape. But you're right, it doesn't diminish any of them. And we've heard several papers here at the SAAs this week about, you know, the Bears Ears landscape, the Greater Chaco landscape, and all the various different indigenous connections to those places.
Which I guess also brings up another point that Cassie was alluding to, too, that it's important to keep in mind and important to remind people regularly that the landscape that people are on today is not necessarily the only landscape that they're connected to, and that removal has occurred. And so, for example, like you're talking about with, you know, Bears Ears and Chaco, it's not necessarily that, you know, people say, oh, but you don't live in Utah, like you're not a Utah tribe, or you're not a, that was not necessarily always by choice. And even if it was by choice, like in the case of the Pueblos, that doesn't mean that there isn't a very real connection still there, and that those places aren't important and they're not, you know, abandoned, quote unquote. So,
but, you know, the importance of being in landscapes that have importance for your people from a cultural perspective, I think, you know, you're talking about forced movements and those kind of things, taking it back to the natural world and the items that grow or that exist in the natural world that are super important for different cultural purposes. I did a video project on river cane, and we had this river cane conference at Mississippi Choctaw, and there was some folks from out west who had been removed, who were saying that, you know, when after removal, they couldn't get access to cane because river cane doesn't grow out in Oklahoma the way it does in the Southeast. And so there were all kinds of cultural changes and issues that came into place, because I think most people know that for all the Southeastern tribes, I assume river cane was a super important product and was used in a million different ways. So what do you do when something that's culturally important, spiritually important, no longer grows where you got moved to? So I think that's another kind of aspect of the natural environment in terms of landscape and cultural landscape and access to certain resources too, that when we think about removal or just migrations and other things is important to keep in mind.
Yeah, and that brings us to a whole other level, thinking back to Tina Steggy's interview on the podcast, looking at, you know, climate change and the effects that that's having on people. And, you know, she's an anthropologist, she's a Marshallese anthropologist, and they're looking at, you know, she and I've had conversations, I think off air, so this is probably new for the podcast, but about, you know, what happens when you no longer have a place tied to your culture, you know, when you have to leave the Marshall Islands in less than 5 years, they're looking at, and what they're trying to do now, looking at potentially, you know, mapping types of projects, but really in this case, true salvage mapping type projects. And I'm going to not keep going with that because it's pretty depressing, but you know.
We were talking with somebody yesterday at the Native American committee reception, and kind of threw out an idea that in this, as we're talking about landscapes and now the climate change and trajectories, you know, archaeologists are big on, you know, long time depth data acquisition for trend identification. And we keep gathering information, but nobody's looking at the next steps, where to go with it. And in the conversation, kind of pointed to, well, look, have a conversation with any indigenous population. They can tell you how to survive in an area. They have. They've witnessed and they have chronicled in their stories, their science, of what to do in those changes. And that, you know, it may look different than, you know, a traditional Western European American style of science, but it's every bit as scientific. And there are lessons to be learned there that actually have application for all. And if we go back to the traditions of host and guest, as a host, I have an obligation to everybody in my neighborhood, whether I have invited or not, to do the best for them. And this may be one of those opportunities. So we got into this discussion of, trying to identify tribes that might want to work towards identifying ways of that they might be comfortable in identifying those kernels that would be of surviving or working with change in a modern construct.
I think that the work of Greg Cajete in particular here at UNM around Native science and his work on Native science is a good framework or model to use for trying to think about how to do that. Especially, I mean, Dr. Cajete has done a lot of work around natural science and kind of incorporating that in with indigenous worldviews. And so I think that's a cool model that of somebody trying to do that kind of theoretical work for how to combine science and indigenous knowledge.
All right. Well, before we close out, I did want to also thank Desiree Martinez and Cogstone Resource Management for providing our space that we're recording in today. So thank you for your support. And we're sad we missed you. Desiree is doing important work right now, raising money for the Native American Scholarship. So if you haven't yet, you should donate for next year. And some of our guests had to step out, but thank you again to all of our guests today.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.